Thank you very much to underline this new function of the religious partnership, the policy makers. I think, of course, one of the sharp difference between Europe and the United States is the difference between freedom of religion and freedom from religion. Marked the French Revolution. And of course, now in Europe we have to cope perhaps with the American version of freedom for religion. We have to implement this idea. So we move to the third paper. The third paper is by Manuel Manonelles. Manuel Manonelles, a political scientist, is specialized in international relations, human rights, and democratization. Of course, siamo in casa, IMA, University of Deusto and University of Padova. We have a long tradition of cooperation with University of Deusto. Since 2005, he is director of the Barcelona Office of the Foundation for Culture of Peace. And in 2009, he took up the direction of the World Forum of Civil Society Networks, Ubuntu Forum. In 2009, also, he became member of steering group of the Jean Monnet Center of European Excellence on Intercultural Dialogue, Human Rights and Multilevel Governance at the University of Padua. And since 2007, he's the special advisor of the chair of Interpress Service. And from July 2005 to November 2006, he has acted as special advisor to the co-chair of the United Nations High Level Group for the Alliance of Civilization. Manonelles has experience in intercultural and interreligious dialogue, both at the local, regional and international level, and is member of different societies and non-governmental organizations, including some think tanks. He gave me a book on the Montserrat document. I was involved in this document because I commented the content of this document concerning the interreligious dialogue. I discovered that he was one of the promoters. Okay, we are at home. Please, Manuel.
Thank you very much, Professor Pace. Indeed, it's a pleasure to be back home, to be back in Padova, to be back in the University of Padova. This, as Professor Papisca always reminds us, and it's at the door of the university, this gymnasium omnidisciplinarum, which is Padova, and this inter and transdisciplinary dimension of the university, which was there since the beginning of the university, and it's still here, and you can see it through the program of this seminar, which is very much inter and transdisciplinary dimension, of course, to be back home at the Human Rights Center, which I want to mention, not because it's our Human Rights Center and because it's part of the organization, but I think it's becoming more and more a clear example and of good practices, not only in Italy, but in Europe, of this combination of academic excellence and deep-rooted interlinkage with the city, with the region, with the reality. Because sometimes it's very easy to find very fine academic institutions, but they are in their ivory tower and the Center of Human Rights in Padova has this double dimension that I think it's... So it's an example of interculturalism in action. So maybe in one of the workshops you can present experience from the center, and of course the linkage with the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence, and all of us we are here, and of course to have Professor Pace, who was my professor on religion and human rights when I was studying here in Padova, so I really feel at home, and I'm happy to be here and honored to be with such distinguished guests, the ones we had yesterday, the ones we have today. Well, I was asked to speak about a very particular subject, which is the culture of peace and the role of civil society in the promotion of culture of peace. Of course, it's a very close relationship because that's the base of the work that our foundation is doing since the year 2000, the year 2000, when it was founded by Federico Mayor, who was a former director general and who was one of the key persons in promoting the development of the concept of the culture of peace and its implementation. So before starting, or at least to put a framework, some of you are very much aware of that, but those maybe that they are younger, that they are not that aware of the details of what really it is a culture of peace. I think it's important we bear in mind that a culture of peace is a unique case of a comprehensive and substantive, some would say holistic, definition of peace, which on the one side, the importance is a substantive definition of peace. So there is a clear linkage between the concept of peace with all the different agendas. So it's not just definition of peace as the absence of violence, but a very in-depth and substantive definition of the linkage between peace and development, peace and human rights, peace and gender, peace and intercultural dialogue, peace and environment. This is one part of the story. But the other part of the story is that, and this is also very important, is that this is the only substantive definition of peace which gathered consensus by the community of nations. Because we have the Declaration and Program of Action for a Culture of Peace, which was approved by the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1999, and it was approved by consensus. So in technical point of view, or also in a political point of view, it's the only document which has this blessing, the whole blessing of international community as a definition of a wide concept of peace, because we are still working with a short-term dimension of peace, only linking with violence, but sometimes we talk about human security, we talk about other concepts, but the only one which is in a such wide concept and it's being recognized is the concept of a culture of peace as it is presented in this Declaration and Plan of Action for a Culture of Peace and Nonviolence of 1999. This Declaration and Program of Action, as I said, it was approved by the General Assembly, and it has especially a very important dimension in the Program of Action. Up to that stage, United Nations declarations, especially those linked with the General Assembly, were much more in the declarative dimension, but here it was include this Program of Action, which is the larger part, so it's a very action-oriented approach to the building of peace, and it's divided in 8 main areas. The first area is education, the second one is sustainable economic and social development, the third one is human rights, the fourth one is gender, it's mentioned as equality between women and men, then we have democratic participation, then we have understanding, solidarity and tolerance, which is the area which is more linked to what today we mean when we talk about intercultural dialogue. Then there is another one on free flow of information and knowledge, because we are very much used to talk about free flow of information and we always forget about free flow of knowledge. And the last one is on international peace and security. So it's also quite, when it was set up in that way, it was clearly to demonstrate that, of course, international peace and security is important, but you will only be able to get international peace of security if you address all the other issues I have been mentioning before. As mentioned, this Declaration and Program of Action of 1999 was followed by the 2000 Manifesto for a Culture of Peace. This was some sort of a very short and pedagogic instrument in order so it could be shared by people on the streets. And this manifesto was signed by more than 75 million of people, so it's probably the document which has been gathering such large support at the global scale. And this was a key one when we talk about civil society and culture of peace, because since the beginning it was clearly identified that either we involve civil society at the core of the initiative or this process of the culture of peace, it will be another of these typical UN processes, which they are very nice, but they end in the shelves of the libraries and they don't have life. So since the beginning, it was very much important to involve civil society, to involve citizens, because there is a difference between society, and civil society organizations. So this manifesto in the year 2000, which was was linked to the International Year for the Culture of Peace, which was also taking place in the year 2000, was the first step to get this citizens' involvement. After that, we had the International Decade for a Culture of Peace and Nonviolence, which was also proclaimed by the United Nations General Assembly. It was from 2001, from 2010, so it was a long, well, it was decades of decades. They have 10 years everywhere. With this we have agreement, a transatlantic agreement that a decade is a decade. And this was an important moment for study and for action, and afterwards I will commend you about what civil society has been doing during this decade. And now we are in 2011, and this year, among other issues which are going to be addressed by the General Assembly of the United Nations, it will be precisely the revision of this decade, whether we have a new decade, whether there is a strong debate about having a new decade linking intercultural and interreligious dialogue with culture of peace. So currently this is a debate we have within civil society in New York and in Geneva. We also have already the debate within the member states, whether this could be a good step forward, and I think it could be quite interesting. Then the question that some people always put on the table, because it's quite interesting, is why UNESCO was working on a culture of peace. Well, UNESCO was working on a culture of peace first because sometimes we forget about the mandates and the foundation of international organizations. We are so used to deal with the current perception of what the international institutions are doing that we forget their foundation. If we go back to the constitution of UNESCO, UNESCO constitution is from 1945, so it's one of the first institutions of the UN system after the Charter of the United Nations in San Francisco. Then one of the first institutions which were set up, it was UNESCO, and it was set up in London, although the base is in Paris. That's why you only have UNESCO, the official name of UNESCO is only in English. It's a very strange, because it was founded in London and then it was transferred to Paris. If we go back to the preamble of the UNESCO Constitution of 1945, we will see the starting of the Constitution, which says, and I quote, "Since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed." End of the quote. So we see that the foundation itself of the institution, of an institution that today we perceive mainly as a technical institution, which is to deal about science and culture, but it's also, it was mainly created for this purpose, to see the role that science, education, and culture could provide to build a culture of peace. And this is something we have to recall from time to time, because it what happens also with many of the UN institutions. We have the perception that UN institutions were created as some sort of technocratic institutions, and we talk about specialized organizations, or we see United Nations as a humanitarian actor, which they are, but the core of these institutions are political, and they were created as political institutions with political objectives, and with the time we have been forgotten that, but it is important to bear in mind the real intention for what they were built. Then, of course, we have this dimension of the mandate and the origin of UNESCO's work. And then this culture of peace process, which it was very much born in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, it also was built in a very particular context. It's the end of the bloc policy. It's the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was a time of the peace dividends. It was a time in which there were a debate about new paradigms. It was what we start to call about the decade of UN optimism, which it was a decade of the 90s, in which we had all these major conferences, the Rio Conference 1992, the Vienna Conference on Human Rights, the Copenhagen Conference. So it was this decade that we start to call it as a decade of the UN optimism, as now that we see how other decades have been working. And it was also in the context of the reflection of what to do with UNESCO, because UNESCO was getting to the 50th anniversary in 1995, so that was why there was an exercise to see what was the origin of UNESCO and what was needed to be retaken in order to ensure that the role of UNESCO was still an important one. So all this started with this very particular context, which is very different from the one in which we are today, and we had the first meeting in 1989, which was the International Congress of Peace in the Minds of Men. So, taking from the mandate of UNESCO, and this took place in Cote d'Ivoire, in Yamoussoukro. Of course, at that time, Cote d'Ivoire was in a different situation than the current one. But it was not only here for, I mean, it was rooted from previous work, and especially the work of Father Felipe MacGregor, who, spite of the name, it's a Peruvian professor and theologian, and he was a Jesuit, who already in 1986 wrote the first book called Cultura de Paz, Culture of Peace, which was a book on peace education. So the roots of this Culture of Peace initiative, so they go back to Peru and to the Jesuits in Peru and to Father MacGregor, which for sure he had some roots in Scotland for the name. So we understand more or less what is the Culture of Peace initiative, which are the roots of this initiative. So we will see that since the very beginning, civil society organizations have been also very much involved in the process. Then I'm going to address which are the instruments and the linkage between the institutional and political initiative of the Culture of Peace. If the computer answers well. As I said, the Declaration of Program of Action of 1999, it's very unique if we compare with other documents of at that time of the United Nations system, because it has a very strong presence since the beginning of the civil society, both in the declaration part, which is the declarative part, but especially in the program of action part, which is the programmatic and the important one. And it's quite innovative in the wording and in the approach in which civil society is addressed. In the declaration part, we have Article 6 and Article 8. When we go to the program of action, we have Article 3 and Article 6. I'm not going to quote them very much, but it's important, for instance, when we go to Article 8, and here it's important to see that when you go to the declaration, because in political terms that's quite relevant, that, for instance, the mention to civil society in the Declaration of Culture of Peace, it's in Article 6 and 8, and this is before even the same declaration mentions the role of UN and UNESCO. So even puts civil society at the forefront of the action. This is something that today you could not do. I mean, today when you deal again with all these kind of declarations, we have been a bit backwards. So this was a moment of quite an innovative dimension, and then there is a very clear linkage between civil society and the academic sector. And then, for instance, when we go in the programmatic part, in the plan of action, and we go to article number 3, it's interesting, I will quote it short, but it's very much in the multidimensional aspect that we have in our center, because it says, and I quote, civil society should be both at the local, regional, and national levels to widen the scope of activities on a culture of peace, end of the quote. So it's interesting to see that already at that time we had this multidimensional approach, which today it's not that much within the political terms. I mean, it's politically correct to talk about that, but in practical terms it's very much difficult to implement within the UN milieu. And then also in Article 6, it's important to notice the fact that they talk about a global movement for a culture of peace. It's the only document which talks about global movement. It's very unique on that, because the UN has been always very careful, especially the UN system as a system, to involve civil society, but to have civil society at their place, having the member states in their predominium, and to have the academic, etc., etc. So I think it's very interesting to see this transversality of the declaration and the program of action, and this will explain the success in which this declaration was implemented through the role of civil society, even when some member states started to, you know, to get out of the culture of peace paradigm. Indeed, as I mentioned several times, the declaration was approved in 1999, so then things changed very fast of the context of 1999 to the context of 2001. So the paradigm in which all of us were working, as I mentioned, the peace dividends, the new era, the end of the Berlin Wall, etc., ended with the 2001 context. We had the Bush administration and the neocon agenda. We had the 9/11 war against terror. So step by step, many member states started to get out of this culture of peace process. There was change of UNESCO director general. The United States were back at the UNESCO. So it's quite interesting to see how in this process, civil society step by step took more presence and more action. So the ownership of the whole decade became more linked to the activities of civil society organizations and to the academia. And it's also interesting to analyze and to discuss and to study, for instance, some certain concepts, like for instance the concept of human security, which is a very good concept to work with, and we were very much supportive of, was hijacked by certain agendas like the neocon agenda. And for instance, inside the UNESCO process, you could see how it was very much introduced, the concept of human security, but the main objective of introducing human security in the agenda, it was to take culture of peace out of the agenda. Because they said that it was complementary, that culture of peace it was redundant. So there was a major effort to introduce human security, especially because within human security you have the wording security, and this for certain countries is very much important, and it was not because there was a good willingness to deal with, to really promote this, but to take culture of peace out. So sometimes you see how certain processes which are very well intended and they are interesting and they are substantive, they are just used in political terms to get rid of other ones. So in this context in which many states were getting out of the culture of peace agenda, it was when this, when civil society became the key actor. Civil society together with academia. An academia which initially was more linked to the UNESCO chairs, etc., etc., but then it was expanded over that. It's the same with civil society. At the beginning, the civil society organizations which were much more working within this process were those linked traditionally with UNESCO, as the UNESCO clubs, the UNESCO centers around the world. By year, a wide number of networks of different civil society actors started to be more and more involved, and talking about multi-dimension, a space in which this had a lot of success, it was also through the local authorities. This is not civil society, but there is the kind of government level which is more close to the society. Italy is a clear example in which culture of peace became very much rooted between the local institutions, through the Tabla della Pace and all the work which has been done through the local authorities, but you have many other countries in which the culture of peace dimension has been very much rooted, initially because of the civil society action, but this very strong interaction between civil society and local authorities, and then you find many centers dealing on culture of peace in many municipalities. Then with the time change after 2005, we see how many states, they come back to the agenda of the culture of peace, and even we see changes in certain constitutions to include culture of peace as part of the declarative part of the constitutional body. We have the case of Bolivia, which is a very particular case, but we see changes in Spain and in other countries in which culture of peace is included in the constitutional or in the regional constitutions or in the amendments of the charters of certain municipalities or even in the charters of several universities or academic institutions. Then time went by, and we got 2005. 2005, it was the first review, 5 years after the declaration and plan of action. And it's important, and this is a work that it was done by the foundation because it was the part of civil society, that at that time, being the first review, and at that time UNESCO was still a bit not extremely comfortable with the culture of peace agenda, but we produced a report in which several Italian institutions were working with us. This is the summary of the report in 2005, in which we identified more than 700 organizations of civil society around the world working on culture of peace issues. And this was quite important to see that culture of peace, although it was only a concept of which officially was 5 years old, I mean, it had started before, but it had become official within the UN milieu, had already a lot of impact. This report was transmitted to the UN General Assembly, and in the debate of the General Assembly of that year, it was recognized by the member states as part to show the strength of culture of peace being mainly rooted in civil society organizations. Having this enormous potential of having these 700 reports, because it's not only identifying 700 organizations, but having 700 reports about what was the work that these organizations were doing within civil society. The next year, in 2006, we did a very small study on good practices of culture of peace. So we went through these 700 reports, and we identified in each of the different levels of activity of the declaration plan of actions, which could be good practices. We always said good practice, because when you say best practice, then you get into trouble. So we said good practice of culture of peace, identifying some of them, and we have some of them which are quite interesting, especially in the area of understanding tolerance and solidarity, which is the one which is more close to the area of intercultural dialogue, because at that time the intercultural dialogue, as in the word, was not clear, so it was defined in that way. And then we went to 2010. At the end of the decade, we again produced a new report. This is the report of 2010, and this one identified more than 1,000 organizations around civil society organizations around the world dealing on culture of peace. And it was based on the report of 2005, but it was expanded in 2010. Both of them were coordinated by Professor David Adams from the US, and were done by a group of youth people. And I don't know if today he's here, because yesterday I saw he was here, Olivier Ritzy-Galson, who I thought he was Swiss, but now it seems to be half Padovan. He was one of the members of this youth team which was preparing this document. And this document, the one in 2010, we presented directly to the President of the General Assembly, so I had the honor to present to him in October 2010. Then it was distributed to all the member states, and I very well remember that, because in order to be able to distribute it, there is an internal rule which says that you need 220 copies, and I went to New York with 180 copies, so we had a big problem with the copies, so we had to run around New York to try to get the extra copies, but this was finally the day after distributed to all the member states of the General Assembly, and then it was in the debate, and several states recognized the importance of the report, but especially the importance of being aware of the work of more than 1,000 organizations, because, to be very frank, it is what the President of the General Assembly told us. We are not that used that civil society takes care of what we decide. He was like that. I mean, for my knowledge, it's the first time we have, after 10 years, 1,000 organizations working in a declaration that it was produced by the General Assembly. So, in one side, it was quite shocking for the General Assembly itself to see how seriously civil society had taken this. And then this was recognized in the debate, and then in the resolution of the last resolution of this General Assembly, the current one, the 65 UN General Assembly, resolution 65-11, in paragraph 9 and 10, they recognize the tremendous work of civil society and the identification of these 1,054 organizations which are working on civil society organizations around the globe which are working on culture of peace, and its identification of some of them, because I clearly can go through the different countries. I know Italy, I know how many organizations are working on Italy, and they are not in the report, because, well, since it was not, the information was not sent in Italian, then all these things. So this means that we only have 1,000, but we have more than 1,000 organizations working. No? Then there is also interesting, there is another report, as you can see, we have a master's in producing reports, but since I have it here, I want to mention it. There is also this report at the same year, at the end of the, which was produced by Federico Mayor, and it was produced by himself, so it was a tough thing, precisely on the institutional development on the culture of peace and nonviolence from 1988 to 2010. And here it's again identified the importance of civil society working in this area. So at the end, what we have seen is that a process which started as a process as a top-bottom, from the top to the bottom, by an intellectual elite from the UNESCO milieu and from certain academic sectors, became the contrary. It became a very much, it's quite paradoxical, but it became owned by civil society and became a bottom-up process. So when this from the bottom, they forgot about what they have created, now the pressure is coming from down. So that's quite interesting to see that the evolution, and it's very much linked to the context in which this took place, but it's important that we witness that. Not to go into too much details, because I could go by each of the report, by each chapter, and you will start to feel asleep about what civil society has been doing in this area. But why this happened? That's the key question. Why this kind of process, which is the typical bottom-up, started to be up to bottom, become bottom-up? Part of of the reasons I already mentioned, because the change of the context, etc., etc. And of course, in the context of the war on terror, there was a strongest need from civil society to identify this kind of paradigms in which you could work to challenge the political discourse at that time. We have the human rights paradigm, we have the different paradigms, but since the culture of peace paradigm, it's a very wide concept in which you have a very coherent and paradigm in which to work, in which the human rights agenda is inside, but you also have the other agendas. This was very much interesting. Then, of course, because it is a process which, since the beginning, it was a very action-oriented. So, as mentioned, the action plan, the program of action, is much larger than the declaration. And as I mentioned before, this is very rare in the UN, because it's, you know, people tend to declare, and then not to commit that much. So, having this very important action-oriented policy was very important in order to get civil society involved. Then also because it was a very long participatory process. Indeed, maybe it was too long, because when you go back to the different, all the kind of meetings that UNESCO organized for about 6 or 7 years to try to involve the academia, to try, there was even meetings with the military staff to see how the military staff with certain military academies in the U.S. in the early 80s to see how the military could be involved, and it was very interesting. But since it was such a long and participatory process, it was very much easy to involve people. Of course, there was many issues dealing with leadership. As we always say, leadership is always important. It's not nice to talk about leadership because we pretend that things, they should work not only because of leadership, but leadership was very much in the process. And then all the process since the beginning was built as civil society friendly, you know, which is a very particular context, but I'm quite worried to say that this is not anymore the reality in which we are living today in the relationship with the UN system. The UN system is very much close to civil society, but in the last years, and this has been witnessed not only by us, but for instance, you have many reports from Civicus. Civicus is a global a network of civil society organizations which is also working on that, and all of us, we are identifying that the UN system, and especially some member states of the UN system, and especially some member states which are from the new powers, which are mainly, we could say, China, but other countries, they are very much trying to close some of the doors of civil society. So that's a very different paradigm in which we are living. Now again, in 2011, we are in a different situation. In UNESCO, there is a new interest in the culture of peace of process. We can witness that in all the documents of the last executive board and of the last General Assembly of UNESCO, in which culture of peace is again a key element, and again, civil society is perceived, and especially this idea of creating a global movement. So have this interlinkage between civil society, with the academic sector, with local institutions, with national governments, with the regional governments. So we are in a new context, and we are in the debate of going to be the next decade, if a new decade is going to be approved. So I think it's very much important that through the exercise we are doing here, we identify the linkage between the intercultural, the interreligious dimension, and the action for a culture of peace. And maybe we are part of these actors which are pressing and which are lobbying at the UN system, apart from the human rights agenda, but through the General Assembly, to be able to achieve a new decade in which there is clear linkage between the culture of peace and the intercultural and interreligious agenda. And that